Chapter 14. I looked at the whole length of Main Street as carefully as was possible in the gray moonlight. It ran on south for about 200 yards, as straight as a die, and then it narrowed a little and started to meander and became residential, with modest homes randomly spaced in yards of varying sizes. The west side of the straight downtown stretch had stores and commercial operations of various kinds, punctuated with narrow alleys, some of which led onward into the scrub and had more small houses on the left and the right. Those stores and commercial operations were matched by similar establishments on the east side of Main Street, neatly in line with the diner and the hotel, and the alleys to the west were matched by broader paved passageways opposite, which linked all the way through to a one-sided street built parallel to and behind Main Street. I guessed that one-sided street had been the whole point of the town in the early days, and was certainly the point in my being there that night. It ran north and south, and had a long line of establishments that faced the railroad track across nothing but a blank width of beaten earth. I imagined old passenger trains wheezing to a stop, with their panting locomotives next to the water tower a little ways up the line, the train's long windowed sides stretching south. I imagined restaurant staff and cafe owners running across the beaten earth and placing wooden steps below the train doors. I imagined passengers stepping down, spilling out, dry and hungry from their long haul, hundreds of them eagerly crossing the width of earth and then eating and drinking their fill. I imagined coins clattering, cash registers ringing, the train whistles blowing, the passengers returning, the trains moving onward, the wooden steps being retrieved, then stillness returning for an hour, then the next train easing in, and the whole process repeating itself endlessly. That single-sided street had powered the local economy, and it still did. The passenger trains were long gone, of course, and so were the cafes and the restaurants. But the cafes and the restaurants had been replaced by bars and auto parts stores and bars and loan offices and bars and gun shops and bars and second-hand stereo stores and bars. And the trains had been replaced by streams of cars coming in from Kellam. I imagine the cars parking on the beaten earth, and small groups of rangers in training spilling out and spending Uncle Sam's money up and down the row. A captive market, miles from anywhere, like Garber had said, just like the railroad passengers back in the day. I had seen the proposition repeated at 100 bases all around the world. The cars would be old Mustangs or Gran Torinos or GTOs, or second-hand BMWs, or Mercedes in Germany, or strange Toyota Crowns, or Datsuns in the Far East, and the beer would be different brands and different strengths, and the loans would be in different currencies, and the guns would be chambered for different loads and different calibers, and the used stereo equipment would operate on different voltages, but other than that, the give and take was exactly the same everywhere. I found the spot where Janice Mae Chapman had been killed easily enough. Pellegrino had said she had bled out like a lake, which meant sand would have been used to soak up the spill, and I found a fresh spreading pile of it in a paved alley near the rear left-hand corner of a bar called Brannan's. Brannan's was about in the center of the one-sided street, and the alley in question ran along its left flank before dog-legging twice and exiting on Main Street between an old-style pharmacy and a hardware store. Maybe the hardware store was where the sand had come from. 3 or 4 60-pound bags would have done the job. It was spread in a neat teardrop shape over the smooth flagstones, about 3 or 4 inches deep. The spot was not directly overlooked. Brannon's rear door was about 15 feet away, and the bar had no side windows. The back of the pharmacy was a blank wall. Brannon's neighbor was a loan office with a Western Union franchise, and its right flank had a window toward the rear, but the place would have been closed at night. No witnesses. Not that there would have been much to witness. Cutting a throat doesn't take much time. Given a decent blade and enough weight and force, it takes as long as it takes to move your hand 8 inches. That's all. I stepped out of the alley and walked halfway to the railroad track and stood on the beaten earth and judged the light. No point in looking for things I wouldn't be able to see. But the moon was still high and the sky was still clear, so I kept on going and stepped over the first rail and turned left and hiked north, walking on the ties like guys used to way back when they were leaving the land and heading to Chicago or New York. I passed over the road crossing, and I passed the old water tower. Then the ground began to shake, just faintly at first, a mild, constant tremor like the edge of a distant earthquake. I stopped walking. The tie under my feet trembled. The rails either side of me started to sing. I turned around and saw a tiny pinpoint of light far in the distance. A single headlight, the midnight train a couple of miles south of me, coming on fast. I stood there. The rails hummed and keened. The ties hammered up and down through tiny, microscopic distances. The gravel under them clicked and hopped. The ground tremors deepened to big bass shudders. The distant headlight twinkled like a star, jumping minutely left and right through hard, constrained limits. I stepped off the track and looped back to the old water tower and leaned against a tarred wooden upright. It shook against my shoulder. The ground shook under my feet. The rails howled. The train whistle blew, long and loud and forlorn in the distance. The warning bells at the roadside, 20 yards away, started ringing. The red lights started flashing. The train kept on coming toward me, for a long time, resolutely distant. Then all of a sudden, right next to me, right on top of me, huge, just insanely massive and impossibly loud. The ground shook so hard that the old water tower next to me danced mutely in place, and I was bounced up and down whole inches. Moving air whipped and battered at me. The locomotive flashed past and then began an endless sequence of cars, hammering, juddering, strobing in the moonlight, hurtling north without pause. 10 of them, 20, 50, 100. I clung to the tarred pole for a whole long minute, 60 long seconds, deafened by squealing metal, beaten numb by the throbbing ground, scoured by the slipstream. Then the train was gone. The butt end of a bulk silo car rolled away from me at 60 miles an hour, and the howl of the wind dropped a half tone, and the earthquake subsided to mild tremors again, and then to nothing, and the screaming rails quieted to a low hiss. The manic bells stopped dead. Silence came back. The first thing I did was change my mind about how far I was going to have to walk to find the wreckage of the blue car. I had assumed it would be close by, but after that awesome display of power, I figured it might be somewhere in New Jersey or Canada.